Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage.
In this episode of First Look, Jonathan Capehart sits down with Ann Garin, Ruth Marcus, and Megan McArdle to discuss Biden's speech at the UN and the potential for a government shutdown. Let's listen.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post. Excuse me, that's a great way to start a Friday. Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, opinion writer for The Washington Post. President Biden and his administration have had a busy week. He was at the UN outlining America's commitment to democracy and vaccines while defending his administration's decision on Afghanistan. Meanwhile, his administration is preparing for a government shutdown in the middle of the pandemic, as it also rings the alarms about an impending and unprecedented default. There's no better person to talk about all of this than the Washington Post White House correspondent, Ann Garin. Ann, welcome to First Look.
Happy to be here, Jonathan.
All right, there's so much news to talk about. I mentioned all those things, but there's breaking news out of Arizona that I just have to ask you about before we get to this, and I'm sure, I'm just wondering, have you heard from anyone at the White House about the breaking news out of Arizona overnight that the Donald Trump-backed Cyber Ninjas audit of Arizona votes in Maricopa County found that President Biden won the state by more votes? Any word out of the White House about this news?
Well, very quickly, not officially, but the White House is privately saying things like, well, Donald Trump did want them to find more votes.
And they did, just not in his favor. Okay, let's move on to another sort of big lie related situation, and that is the January 6th Select Committee. Yesterday, the Select Committee issued its first subpoenas to Trump loyalists Kash Patel, Mark Meadows, Dan Scavino, and Steve Bannon. The very same day, the Post reported that the White House is leaning towards releasing information to Congress about what Donald Trump and his aides were doing during the insurrection at the Capitol. It's a huge legal and political, there are huge legal and political ramifications here. Will the White House, do you think, go from leaning to doing? And then what kind of information might they release?
Well, I don't know whether they will go to the doing part, but certainly the indications are that the White House thinks it has full authority to release this information, and perhaps earlier than is laid out in a very complicated statute. Certainly after 60 days under that statute, the White House has the authority to release it, even if Donald Trump has objected in the meantime. This boils down to a rather tricky question of whether Trump as an ex-president can credibly claim some version of executive privilege, which is what sitting presidents frequently use to prevent the release of all kinds of information and documents. Mm-hmm. Also, I would say that the House-led, the Democratic-led committee believes that it has the authority to both collect and release this information. So my gut is that the information will come out. I just don't know how officially it will come out from the White House.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be talking to Ruth Marcus and Megan McArdle about that executive privilege claim possibly coming from Donald Trump in the opinions portion later on. Let's talk government shutdown. Yesterday, the White House told agencies to prepare for the first government shutdown of the Biden presidency, but also during the pandemic, which, you know, telling agencies to get ready is normal protocol. But what is the president doing to avert a government shutdown?
Well, that is a very good question. We have not heard from the president on this subject in many days directly. In fact, we haven't really heard directly from him in a question and answer format for quite some days. The OMB directive yesterday to agencies is, as you noted, standard 7 days before a deadline. That deadline is the end of next week. It's one of several important deadlines next week that both the House and the White House are working against. And of course, the big question happens when all of those things come before the Senate and what the Senate will agree to, in addition to the shutdown question, which is about the budget. There is a separate but related question about raising the debt ceiling. I actually prefer the term borrowing limit. I think it's easier for people to understand what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And whether all those things get wrapped into one piece of legislation or two, whether Nancy Pelosi has to backtrack, there are a lot of moving pieces here. And thus far, we haven't heard the president say directly, here's how I would like it to go.
Right. The only thing we know that the president has been actively involved in is in the negotiations over the reconciliation package and trying to build bridges between moderates and progressives within the Democratic Party about the hard infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill. But we'll be talking about that probably next week. And let's talk about the president's speech at the UN. How was it received? It was Biden's first speech there at the UN General Assembly as president of the United States.
I would say the reception was polite and muted. The president really didn't really make any news in his UN speech. He did draw some applause at the end for some remarks about unity and alliances and so forth. But much of the speech really was directed at China without naming China or making it explicit that he was talking about China. And that sets up a lot of complicated dynamics. Many of the countries listening to him, whose representatives were listening to him during that speech, have their own complicated relationships with China. And many U.S. allies, including prominently in Europe, are nervous about the somewhat confrontational stance that President Biden is taking toward China. They have their own commercial and other relationships, borrowing relationships and all kinds of things with China. And they are hesitant to, jump in the boat with the Biden administration in what some see as a needlessly confrontational approach. The other main thing he was doing there was defending the withdrawal from Afghanistan and, in his view, the pivot to much more important topics, namely China. Making the argument that he has made before, that the fights of the future are elsewhere, they're not counterterrorism focused, they're not in Afghanistan.
When it comes to the allies, I distinctly remember it was President Biden and President Macron of France when they were at the G7, where President Macron said, quote, America is back. And there is the president months later, 2 or 3 months later, at the UN General Assembly in the middle of a huge fight with France over the submarine deal with Australia. I'm just wondering how are the allies, or how were the allies feeling about President Biden in the middle in that speech? Do they believe that America truly is back, given all the things we've seen in those 3 months?
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of disappointment in the way the president has handled alliances leading up to that speech. Again, the reception for the speech itself was polite. He said a lot of the right things in their view. I will note that the G7 moment is even worse than we knew at the time. It was that same weekend, that very set of meetings during which the president was getting this secret sub deal going with Australia. So it was kind of amazing, right? Like, there he is sitting out on the beach back slapping with Macron, like, my friend. That I did not have major diplomatic rupture with France on my UN bingo card this year, so bad on me.
One more question, Anne, before I let you go, and that is something else that happened this week that was pretty startling, and that was what was happening on the southern border with Mexico and the U.S. Border Patrol on horseback, forcibly preventing Haitian migrants from crossing the border. Also, the Biden administration deporting Haitian migrants who haven't been in Haiti since for about 10 years. They're coming up through South America, deporting them to Haiti, which is still reeling from the big earthquake a month or so ago. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is a problem for the White House on many fronts. I mean, first, you have a humanitarian problem at the border. Second, you have these disturbing images of the way the Border Patrol, part of the U.S. government, is handling that with Democratic lawmakers and civil rights groups piling on the White House, saying, how in the world can you countenance this? Maxine Waters saying it looks like slavery to her. There's a whole lot going on there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there is the larger question for the White House of the policy here, which is a continuation of the Trump administration's policy of deporting when possible on public health grounds as a pandemic control measure. A lot of people see that as a fig leaf for just getting rid of people who might otherwise be, you know, admitted to the country, right, and avoiding an immigration fight. And, you know, we had the special envoy for Haiti resigning over this yesterday.
Right. And Garen, as always, when you and I get to talking, we've got too many topics and not enough time. So we're gonna have to leave it there. And Garen, White House correspondent for the Washington Post, thank you very much for coming back to First Look.
My pleasure.
All right, we're gonna keep the conversation going about the big decisions coming from the White House with our opinions roundtable in just a few minutes. Stay with us. Let's go to the opinion side of the Washington Post, where we will find Washington Post deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus and Washington Post columnist Megan McArdle. Ruth, Megan, welcome to First Look.
Good morning. I'm sorry it was such a slow week.
No, really? Right? Okay, so we've got to start this conversation talking about the breaking news out of Arizona, the cyber ninjas audit, the Trump-backed cyber ninjas audit that was supposed to show that Arizona was stolen. And in fact, what they found out was that actually Joe Biden got more votes than initially initially counted. I'm sorry. Ruth, your reaction to this first, and then I'll go to you, Megan.
Oh, well, it's obvious what happened. The audit was rigged. It's a rigged audit. What else can President Trump say? I mean, as with so many things, if you had to write this in a Veep-type TV script, you could not come up with a better outcome that even these knucklehead non-auditors could not invent votes, new votes for Donald Trump that would cause Donald Trump to win Arizona or be president, which he apparently believes he is.
Huh. And you know, Megan. Oh. That's right. And you know, Megan, this comes out just as there's Donald Trump called on Texas to do an audit of its votes, and he won Texas. And even more insane, the governor said, yeah, sure, let's do it. Is there no end to this insanity?
I'm not sure there is. I mean, I think it's like this kind of article of faith now. And, you know, it's sort of like if you look back at these doomsday cults that predict the end of the world on a date certain, and then the world does not end. And you would think that would be the point at which the doomsday cult disassembles. But no, often they just double down. Well, we got the date wrong, but. And I think that's what you're seeing here. Look, what else does he have? You're seeing, I saw even crazier Josh Mandel, who's in a difficult primary in Ohio running against J.D. Vance, called for an audit of all 50 states, including Ohio, which Trump won overwhelmingly. It's nuts, right? It's completely nuts, but it is this absolutely, like they have so little else to go on at this point, right? What is mm-hmm. the Republican Party except slavish loyalty to Trump and the crazy notion that he actually secretly won the 2020 election? And, you know, they can't let it go because that mm-hmm. would require, actually, I don't know, come up with some policies, perhaps have an agenda, and they're not ready for that.
You know, John, yeah, go ahead, Ruth. Chuckling. We're chuckling because this seems so ludicrous, but honestly, we shouldn't be chuckling because the impact of this kind of argument is toxic. It's toxic for public trust in the outcome of elections. We see that in the polling. So while I said ha, so I'm criticizing myself, we should probably cut the chortling and start worrying a little bit more about these kinds of arguments.
No, well, you're absolutely right. And I was going to make the transition. You used the great word, toxic. The Arizona audit and all these audits and the questioning of the 2020 election results, they are toxic. And we saw the impact of those lies, the impact of the big lie on January 6th with the insurrection. And that leads me to asking about the January 6th Select committees sending out the subpoenas to Kash Patel, Steve Bannon, Mark Meadows, and Dan Scavino to produce, to come to the Select Committee. Ruth, I mean, this marks a turning point for this investigation. Do you think these four folks are actually going to comply with the subpoenas?
Well, I'm going to put Steve Bannon to one side because he does not have any valid claim of executive privilege because he was not working for or in the White House or administration at the time. As to the others, it's a really complicated legal question about what, and undecided really, as I understand it, about what authority a former president might have to invoke executive privilege to stop either the documents, and he's got a less good claim on the documents because to a large extent, the current president, President Biden, is the boss of the National Archives with regard to that, and he has waived executive privilege. But Trump could try to mess up the documents. He could also assert executive privilege with respect to his former aides. That my understanding has been, by the way, that he's been reluctant to do that in previous incarnations of this argument because he didn't want to actually have to ante up the legal fees to do it. But assuming he is willing, seriously, his lawyers didn't want to do it for free. So to the extent he's willing to write that check, we could have this tied up in litigation for some time. But this is an important step, and I'm just going to say one last thing. It's also necessary but not complete step. We need to be looking at what happened on January 6th, but we also need, as I've written before, to be looking at some of the sort of pre-coup, silent coup things that were happening at the Justice Department even before January 6th.
Right. And Megan, same question to you in terms of the significance that these subpoenas, these four subpoenas to Trump loyalists, former Trump administration officials, the significance that they've gone out.
Look, I think it's a sign that Democrats are going to go big and litigate this. I'm not entirely confident that's the right decision for the country, even though I stood four square against January 6th, thought it was at like a very serious attempt to overthrow the results of a legitimate election, and that this is incredibly corrosive and toxic to the civic fabric. My question is, at this point, is this a question that litigating it actually changes any minds among the American public, actually makes it less likely that this is going to happen in the future? And I'm not sure that the answer is yes. And if the answer is not yes, even though I think it should, right? I'm not defending I'm just looking kind of at the practical political level here. If we're just arguing about something where basically everyone's mind is set and no one's mind is going to be changed, I think you have two costs to that. And one is that it sucks up political oxygen from other stuff the Biden administration might want to do. But the other problem is that it potentially just causes people to dig in even further, causes people to double down on the election audits and so forth, rather than putting it behind us. And I know that this sounds crazy to a lot of people, that like the idea that something that serious that we could ever just say, okay, we're going to move on now. But I think if you look at history, in fact, very few national issues are resolved by having endless national conversations about them of this magnitude. I think, honestly, they usually are settled when people move on to something else. And I kind of wonder if we aren't just making the wounds worse rather than better.
Okay, I'm Megan, I'm going to have to take issue. How can you say that no good for the country to, for the select committee to do this? We're talking about an attack on our democracy at one of the more pivotal moments when the Electoral College votes were being counted. I mean, I hear all the things that you're saying and I understand where you're coming from, but at some point, Ruth, jump in here. This has to be investigated. And even if nothing comes of it, it still has to be investigated.
Okay, so Jonathan, my head's exploding too. Well, thank you, Megan. Look, the argument we've been having all along is, okay, you can't charge a president criminally while he's in office. It would be really disruptive to national unity if you charged a president criminally when he's out of office, even if you can. And now Megan is arguing that we shouldn't even, because it would be disruptive to national unity, figure out what the heck happened on January 6th and in the run-up to January 6th and how we can prevent this again. The point is not to heal or knit together the country, because honestly, doing this isn't going to make things any worse. The point is to find out what happened here in the United States of America that allowed a coup to near succeed in 2021 and the run-up to January 6th. And it is imperative that we find that out. I could not disagree more strongly.
Well, go
ahead, Megan.
So let me say, first of all, I really doubt we're going to figure out what led up to this, right? I'm not actually sure that like deep insights are going to come out of this, and that we're somehow going to understand how we could stop it in the future.
Facts. Let's get some facts. Let's get some documents. Let's get some emails. Let's get some testimony.
But the second thing is like, look, I wanted Trump impeached and removed from office after January 6th. I frankly would have supported impeaching him and removing him from office before January 6th if they could have gotten the votes. If you could have criminally charged him, I would have been in favor of that. My point is that at this point, if you could criminally charge him now, I would be in favor of that and prevent him from running again. But absent that, absent the ability to actually remove Trump from the political scene, which I don't see this generating, I question whether spending enormous amounts of political capital and effort on this. I'm not against it. I'm not like upset that it's happening. I am just worried that it is not, in fact, going to move us any further towards a less coup-ridden or less whatever you want to call what happened on January 6th for our Republican listeners, towards a democracy where that can't happen again. I'm not sure this is moving us in that direction. I think it might be treading water, which is fine. I think it might actually end up going in the other direction, which is not.
Ruth, my question here is, let's take the attention for a minute away from Donald Trump and talk about the signal these subpoenas and this investigation sends to would-be Donald Trumps, to those people who, the Josh Hawleys and the Ted Cruzes and the Marjorie Taylor Greens, to say, if you try to do this, there will be some kind of consequence for this. Isn't there a signal value here to these investigations?
Well, I am not sure that those guys can be very effectively chilled in their bad behavior. But I do think that we have had in every significant event in modern American history a look, often a congressionally authorized or congressionally conducted look into what went wrong. We had the 9/11 Commission. We've had commissions about many, many other things. We should have had a different kind of commission, but Republicans, that was more independent and that might have made Megan's point, might have calmed down people a little bit more. But we have the group that we have, the select committee that we have, and to think that we should not have an understanding of what happened on that day and in the run-up to it because it won't change future events is just not the way we've conducted, and for good reason, not the way we've conducted oversight business in the United States before this.
Okay, We spent so much time on this that we now have less than 2 minutes, and it's a hard out. We got to be out in 2 minutes. We didn't talk about the government shutdown, impending government shutdown, raising the debt ceiling, tax increases proposed by the Democrats, COVID boosters decision, the president's speech at the UN. In 15 seconds, give me your final thoughts on any of those issues. Megan first.
I think that the debt ceiling has long signaled that American governance is fundamentally broken, that Congress is incapable of legislating in a normal way, and that it points to all of the deeper problems with all of these other things, and the fact that the Democratic tax framework doesn't seem to actually be a framework. It's just an announcement that there is maybe going to be a framework at some point in the future.
Right.
And I think that this is, we are a broken nation, and we need to figure out how to heal.
And Ruth. 15 seconds, seriously.
Republican recalcitrance on the debt ceiling, Mitch McConnell's recalcitrance on the debt ceiling is shocking even me, because this isn't just playing politics. This is playing with economic fire and the potential for burning down the economy.
And Ruth, I'm just going to let you know, I am going to try for this weekend to write a column about the debt ceiling, because the Bipartisan Policy Center put out its the nerdtastic sheets that I've been writing about for 10 years now. So be on the lookout for that. Ruth Marcus, Megan McArdle. Yes, ma'am. Ruth Marcus, Megan McArdle, we're out of time. Thanks for coming to First Look. Head to WashingtonPostLive.com to find more information about our upcoming programs. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Thank you for watching Washington Post Live's First Look.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at WashingtonPostLive.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.